You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Libraries are filled with guides. Travel guides, consumer guides, health guides. The list is nearly endless. And at their best, they are useful. At the least, probably harmless. But what about guides to establishing and sustaining a global empire? Yes, that too can be found in some libraries. One such guide was released early this year by the Obama administration. It is a guidance for the Pentagon. The title, Sustaining U.S. Global Leadership, Priorities for 21st Century Defense. To examine the content of this guide, we've contacted Dr. Joseph Gerson. He is Disarmament Coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee. We've reached him in Massachusetts. Greetings, Joseph, and welcome back to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Well, hello to you, and thank you for having me back.
This is a guidance, came out in early January. When was the previous guidance pronounced, and by whom?
The last guidance came out in the last Bush administration at a period of misplaced U.S. triumphalism following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it had ridiculously ambitious goals, the idea of being able to fight two major wars, two different parts of the world at the same time. And it provided the foundation for, among other things, a massive buildup in both the U.S. military spending.
These guidances are not just PR projects. They really are practical plans. So they're not stretchable from declaring one objective and then simply hiding another objective within it.
Well, you know, certainly there's always a lot of flexibility in different ways that language can be interpreted. But I think that this strategic guidance is designed to essentially to do two things, to develop strategies for the U.S. in a world that has now changed, a world in which U.S. power is relatively diminished and China is rising as the primary strategic competitor. And secondly, to be able to do that within the context of the spending limits by the United States. So if you put yourself in the middle of that matrix, the idea is how then to best structure the U.S. military so that it can maintain, as the title of it says, U.S. global leadership, which of course is another word for U.S. global dominance.
Okay, let's have a look at what are the highlights of this strategy, and then after that we can go into a little more detail of each of the parts.
Well, the two or three most essential elements. One is it reinforces what's called the U.S. pivot to Asia and the Pacific. The U.S. has been a neo-imperial power in Asia-Pacific really for more than a century. And you know, we've maintained 100 military bases and installations in Japan, a similar number in Korea. But even so, what this guidance does is it says this is to be the primary focus of U.S. Military planning preparations. It also notes that while winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a second priority remains the Persian Gulf, primarily because of its oil and its function, therefore, in the global economy. You have other elements, how this gets paid for, where the reductions come. In significant measure, they come from Europe. The perception is that NATO now extends to the borders of Russia. Russia is not seen as a major threat, although a potential threat, and so the ability to draw down U.S. forces, not totally, but to a degree in Europe. And then high priority given to high-tech warfare preparations, whether it's cyber warfare, space warfare, and so on, and heavy investment in technology.
And in terms of monetary allocation, the Bush administration doubled the military budget between the beginning and the end of the Bush administration, and that's not saying that it started from a low point by any means. What does the Obama projected allocations for this plan, this guidance?
What this essentially does is it significantly slows the growth of military spending. The projections with all kinds of new weapon systems and the cost of maintaining quite as large a force as in the past is simply not sustainable. And so what this does is ostensibly provides the foundation for cutting at least $500 billion, perhaps $1 trillion, out of the budget over a long-term period. But in the short term, it basically has an increase of U.S. military spending for next year of about 4%. And the reality is that after the elections next November, either the Obama administration will be in a position to fulfill this, to stay on course, or if there's a Republican government, of course, they can change it and go back to increasing spending and cutting still more essential social services and programs.
Okay, you said that China is one of the key focal points. We tend to think of China and it as a new theme in the scene, but is that really the case?
Well, China's been a major preoccupation for the United States since about the mid-1990s. I can remember actually talking with some scholars in Europe and after I'd spent some time interviewing people at the State Department, and they were astounded to learn that China was perceived as the rising power and the focus of the increasing focus of U.S. strategy. Well, this is now fundamentally the case. I think the relationship is best described as competitive interdependence. The two economies are obviously mutually dependent on one another. At the same time, as China rises, there's fears that this means a loss, a zero-sum kind of game for the United States. And so the U.S. is basically building forces both to more thoroughly surround China and also concentrating on building weapon systems that well, they have a very peculiar language in the strategy, which it's something along the lines of anti-access, countering anti-access plans. So as China is, for example, building, creating missiles that can go over the ocean very, under radar, very, very low and very fast, ostensibly able to destroy aircraft carriers, the United States is looking to build technology that can negate those missiles and basically keep them from hitting the targets. It's interesting. I mean, if you look at the world from a Chinese perspective, what you see is Korea, where the United States has a foothold there and a potential threat. You have deep historic divisions still between China and Japan. Japan is a near nuclear power, and as one former prime minister described it, an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the United States. And you have U.S. bases then going around Guam, Singapore, Philippines, Australia. So there's a perception that they're hemmed in. They have ambitions and relationships, say, to contested territorial waters in the South China Sea, or as the Philippines call it, the Filipinos call it the West Philippine Sea. So there's tension, there's struggle for resources, and both sides are positioning themselves to to gain advantage. But clearly, China's still quite a number of years behind the United States militarily.
In the Middle East, we have the, you're saying, the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, Saudi Arabia are centerpieces. What is the strategy there with regards to the Obama new plan?
Well, I think we just saw it in with the $30 billion arms sales to Saudi Arabia and other GCC nations. basically to offset Iranian military power. Again, if you look at the map, you'll see that Iran is quite thoroughly surrounded by military bases and allies. So the United States is attempting to reinforce that in the context of the changes of Arab Spring. So there's the irony where you have Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, saying that the Chinese and the Russian vetoes of come to condemning Syria in the Security Council were disgusting, in her words. At the same time, the United States has been quite happy to see Saudi Arabia help put down Arab Spring in Bahrain and have a repressive environment there. So, you know, when you think about democracy, Saudi Arabia is not the first country that comes to mind. But the game there for a long time has been to maintain U.S. dominance, oil being the still basically the most important resource in terms of the global economy. So the U.S. Has made all kinds of moral compromises and continues the process of supporting repressive governments in order to have that.
I take it your word irony would be, in my equivalent, hypocrisy.
It's hypocritical, is to say the least. I mean, it's just classic hypocrisy. But again, this is what big powers do.
Russia was the major until its collapse, the Soviet collapse of the Soviet Union, the major antagonist to the United States, or vice versa, mutual. What role is Russia cast in the new guidance for the Pentagon?
Well, it's complicated. Russia is described as remaining important in U.S. security planning. And clearly, with a major nuclear arsenal, it's a major source of concern. At the same time, I think it's important to understand what the Obama reset button has been about. I think there are aims, certainly in a number of circles, to try to bring Russia into the larger West and to add it to the Western forces under U.S. and NATO. That can ultimately contain China. There's an interesting article in Foreign Affairs a few months ago in which it was said that, look, China's rise does not inevitably mean it's going to become the world's dominant power, that if we can more deeply integrate the United States, the European Union, and bring Russia into the mix, then the West can continue to dominate. So you have pressure there. The terms and conditions for bringing Russia in have to do with it becoming more a nation under rule of law, more democracy, and clearly the recent rounds with Putin haven't advanced that.
So it's part of a game of trying to, from the old Nixon era, split China and Russia and incorporate Russia into a European, Western, American-dominated alliance.
Absolutely, that's the long-term game that's being played here, China. It's interesting. I mean, China, you know, the United States broke China off from the Soviet Union, and we had essentially a tacit alliance with China. The purpose of that alliance ceased to be when the Soviet Union collapsed, and both Russia and China found that facing the greater power, it was in their interest to have much closer collaboration. At the same time, there are issues that are there between Russia and China. Among them has to do with Siberia, very thinly populated, only recently really populated and controlled by Russia. You've got a dynamic Chinese economy pushing into it with Chinese migrants coming in as well. And over the longer term, who controls Siberia may be a real question.
We didn't mention, I didn't raise the question of nuclear weapons. They're not directly part of this guidance, but there is some plan to reassess the U.S. Nuclear arsenal, which is now at the stage of being able to wipe out the world. Is there any comment you want to make about the role of nuclear weapons in this overall U.S. strategy?
Well, actually, there is a direct reference to nuclear policy, and what it indicates is that it's possible that the U.S. may be able to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in its overall strategy, and that in doing so, find that we have more nuclear weapons than we need. And I've just had to finish writing a paper on U.S. nuclear policy, and found myself somewhat surprised that I did need to concede that the Obama administration does seem to be serious in moving to reduce the size of the arsenal. With its increased, the perception is, the way to understand it, on the one hand, has to do with cost. No reason to spend more money for more nuclear weapons than you need. But on the other hand, I think there's been a perception that the perhaps the greatest security threat to the United States is nuclear weapons proliferation. And if you look carefully at, say, the Shultz-Kissinger non-Perry initiative, what you see is that there was an understanding on their part that unless the United States took some serious action toward at least nuclear weapons in U.S. Foreign and military policy, that we would lose any leverage in terms of trying to move for non-proliferation. So we may see, there's actually a study going on now within the Pentagon and in the administration over the possibility of reducing the arsenal by a third or even greater. That would only come after further negotiations with Russia. But one can hope that with more pressure we can push this further along.
Now, you referred to the previous guidance for the Pentagon being that of the Bush administration, the wars that have been waged even before the Bush administration, from the former Yugoslavia to Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, at best are a very mixed bag from the point of view of American objectives being realized. So in the context of the decline as well of the American empire, at least a lot of discussion along that theme, do you think the U.S. has the capacity to achieve what Obama's guide identifies as its goals?
Well, I think the major weakness over and above the reality that the rest of the world won't tolerate dominance by any country, strategically, one of the things that the guidance emphasizes is quote unquote burden sharing. That means both financial assistance and, as we saw with the Libya war, other countries taking on more of the war fighting responsibilities, bloodletting and bleeding. In the midst of the European economic crisis, it's difficult to imagine the European countries increasing their military spending. In fact, they've been reducing it. I think one of the places to look to see how some of this plays out will be the NATO summit, which will be held in Chicago in May. I'm in the midst of organizing a conference there. There'll be demonstrations. But clearly the Obama administration's goal is to hold the Europeans' feet to the fire, insisting that they increase their funding for their militaries, and also that they recommit to NATO's new priority of out-of-area operations. The war in Libya was a classic example of the NATO's new strategic concept, the idea that it's not so much focused anymore on the defense of Europe, Western Europe, but more on securing resources internationally.
Lastly, what are the consequences of this guidance? Not for the rest of the world, we can see the horrors that is promising, but for Americans themselves.
Well, I think there are multiple consequences. I mean, one, it clearly commits the United States to ongoing war fighting. What this means, just in terms of the moral fiber of the country, what it means in terms of wasted resources. What it means in terms of my grandchildren, for example, being seen as enemies and alienated, isolated from the rest of the world. Those are all huge costs. Over and above that, you've got the huge financial cost, really continued growth of the military, at a time when you were losing all kinds of services. Our states are in debt, schools are our schools are losing teachers, they're crumbling. We don't have the money to invest in the kind of infrastructure we need so that we can have 21st century jobs and so that, again, my children and grandchildren can have economic security. So it's a self-destructive process. You know, one of the realities is you can't remain a great power while you hollow out your economy and your moral fiber, and this seems to be what's happening.
Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Okay, well, thank you, and keep up your good work.
Alrighty. I've been speaking with Dr. Joseph Gerson. He is Disarmament Coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee, and we reached him in his office in Massachusetts.